Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.
Welcome to The Soul Knows, and I'm excited to be here again. This is the third show, and we're going to talk about thinking, and on different levels of thinking, and how does that work, but it's more complicated than that because we're using tools to know about thinking. And so I've invited a tool expert about life, tools for life. And he teaches the structure of life. And he'll tell us more about it. He's been a guest on my Energy Stew show many, many times. And I'm glad to do this show with Alexander Dunlop. Alexander, welcome to The Soul Knows.
Thank you, Peter. I love the title of your show, The Soul Knows. The Soul Does Know. And thank you for your fabulous introduction. I would say I'm someone who's done a lot of thinking about thinking and have come to certain specific conclusions, which I imagine we're going to get into today.
Yeah. And you have a long life history of thinking. as we all think we do, but you've taken it to some extremes.
I've taken it to the nth degree, pun intended, with my nine of hearts. I have done it to the extreme. And as a result, I feel like I have something interesting to say about the topic. And so we'll see. We'll see if your audience agrees.
Right. So you mentioned the nine of hearts. So let's let the audience know what your tools are about.
Sure. Well, after a long spiritual journey, which I've talked about elsewhere in my book and on my website, which is thesourcecards.com, after a long spiritual journey, much to my surprise, I found the answers that I was looking for about the meaning of life hidden in plain sight in what we all think of as just an ordinary, quote-unquote, deck of playing cards. It's actually an ancient language of life, ancient symbology that was hidden in plain sight. It predates the biblical monotheistic tradition, and it was persecuted by this same tradition and buried as much as it could have been buried and hidden and persecuted, but yet remained alive. And now it's coming back to light, to our conscious awareness, I believe, because we're at a point of a quantum leap in our human consciousness. And this ancient toolkit, I do believe, will provide us the foundation to understand the structure of our reality so that we know who we are, why we're here, what this is all about. It'll give us the conscious awareness that we need to forge a more enlightened society. That's how I look at it. That's what I think about it.
That's wonderful. And we've talked about it many hours over the years. and I agree that this information, it really enlightens people about themselves and life and explains so much of the whys and wherefores of our consciousness and how it's here to perform.
Yep. Well, yes, and for those who maybe this is the first time hearing or just as a way to give a brief general introduction, we're talking about the, quote, playing cards, the 52 cards in the deck, just like there are 52 weeks in the year. Four suits, four seasons, 13 cards in the deck in each suit, 13 weeks in each season. And then when you add up the face values of the ace through the king, which is 1 through 13, because the jack, the queen, and the king are 11, 12, and 13, that's their values. Add up all those face values for each suit, 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4. So when you do that, for all the 52 cards, you add up the face values, you get 364. And the Joker is the fifth element in the four-part construct, which mathematically 5/4 reduces to 1 1/4. So it's a perfect model of our solar year. And in ancient times, and it is ancient, it goes all the way back to Sumerian mythology, where they talk about the tablets of destiny that were gifted to them by their gods, probably extraterrestrials. It's an ancient toolkit, ancient language, and in ancient times, books didn't have bindings, like books of the Bible written on scrolls and parchment, and they were still known as books. So here we have this unbound book of 52 loose leaves that accurately represents the seasons and the cycles of the Earth rotating around its axis on its journey and its solar year. So it is none other than a little book of our life on Earth. That's how it would have been known in ancient esoteric spiritual societies.
And who would know that by the way the public uses these cards for game purposes?
Yep.
And it, you know, it's wonderful how many games there are using these cards.
Yeah.
And so everybody's familiar with them. But then I know from my experience, when you mention to people, oh, these cards are structure of life and ancient beginnings, it's hard to cross the bridge to what that means versus just playing gin rummy or poker or solitaire or whatever.
Well, that's a great segue. That crossing the bridge is actually the difficulty there is because of mental attachments of what people think that it is. And it's interesting even that you use that analogy of crossing the bridge. It's an analogy that Buddha used in his teaching, where he says that his teaching is like a raft to take you from one side to the other, to cross the shore, to help people get across that bridge, to shift and transform, to have a paradigm shift in their thinking. And I have encountered that a lot, as you have too, that people have fixed ideas about what they think these cards are. And it can be, for some people, very difficult to let go of those mental attachments and to cross over into a whole new way of thinking about the exact same thing.
Well, because you're offering deep understandings about life through the cards that people aren't ready to comprehend.
Yeah.
And so we're going to comprehend a lot today.
Well, yes. I'll just jump right in that the thing that I've been reflecting on most recently that I haven't yet taught publicly, and so I'm excited to talk about it today publicly with you for the first time, is how you mentioned the structure of reality, that these cards represent the structure of reality. The four suits represent the four domains of our human existence, of our reality. So you have the spade represents consciousness, which also is time. Consciousness is time. That's a whole other conversation. We can maybe broach that topic as well today if you want. The club, which I'm wearing on my shirt, the clover, is a flower. It's a symbol of thinking, the spinal cord and the brain, which is actually like a tree. This is a rudimentary symbol of our central nervous system. And then we have the heart, which is the suit of the emotional field, obviously enough. And then the diamond, which is symbolic of all the vibrations of life that have hardened into a material form, symbolized by the hardest known substance, which is a diamond. Between consciousness, thinking, feeling, and the physical domain, anything we can see, taste, touch, or smell, that is the domain of our experience. That is our reality construct across these four axes. And the biggest problem that we've faced as humanity has been the confusion of different levels, the conflation of one level with another, where we think that we're talking about consciousness, spades, but in fact, we're still talking about thinking. We haven't left the domain of thinking, where thinking functions with concepts, labels, words, abstractions. These are all in the domain of thinking, and that's wonderful to use concepts and logic and abstraction. That's how we can create anything, and that's how we can have discourse. We can utilize words and logic, language, concepts to talk about things.
Right, it creates the language of the mind.
Yeah.
and it's harder to conceive the language of the mind at the higher consciousness level. So we reduce it down to a mental level so that we can explain it.
Well, we confuse it. This is the big thing is we confuse the concept with the reality. We think that by talking about it, we actually know it, but all we're doing is creating a label and a construct and an abstraction. So if I talk to you about love and mention anything about love and love and love this and love, if we talk about the concept of love, that's not at all the same thing as the experience of love, where love is the experience at the heart domain, at the heart level of our existence. And this, of course, is another problem that often arises for people, is they confuse thinking about love with the actual experience of love. So that's another way in which we get trapped in our thinking, and we think we know, but all we are doing is thinking. It's not the same as feeling or knowing.
And then we have the heart suit, which has many ways of describing love through each number. And so, again, it's a language that we apply to concepts that allow us actually to make sense, mental sense of lives.
Right. So now this is a very deep topic. So we're going to blast up. We're going to go down the rabbit hole now. The value of thinking is represented mythologically, anthropomorphically, in the idea of Lucifer. Because Lucifer is the light bearer. He brings light. And I remember reading in Helen Keller, if you know or your audience knows who Helen Keller was, who unable to see or hear, I think, as well. She had multiple disabilities. And she describes that when she first got words for something, it was as if a light went on, and suddenly she had a language because the words shined a light on it, where before it was just kind of amorphous, nebulous, unknown. The words were like light bearers for her, and that was that's a big clue to the value and the meaning of what words can do. When we accurately name something, we're shining a light on it. And then you and I and whomever else we're talking to, even now, I'm using words to shine a light. So words can shine a light. And that's represented, again, mythologically, symbolically, anthropomorphically, in the idea of Lucifer, the light bearer. However, consciousness, which is symbolized by spades, is the highest order. To be conscious, to be aware, it's analogous in our anthropomorphization of this domain of our existence. It's analogous to divinity. We ascribe divinity to consciousness. And we even say that consciousness, pure being. And we ascribe divinity to it, transcendence to it. And that's, again, anthropomorphically represented in the idea of God. In the story of the fall, it's when Lucifer sets himself up as equal to God. And what we can say now by understanding this language of life that was hidden in plain sight as playing cards is what we mean by that is whenever we set up clubs or thinking as equal to consciousness, that's when we experience a fall from grace. And what that means is whenever we confuse the abstraction with the reality, whenever we think that by talking about it, we now know about it. That's not what it means. We can talk about it. I can talk about love. I can talk about anything and shine a light on it, but I may not know it. I may not have the conscious awareness of it in my being. I can still talk about it. But the great mistake that we make in humanity is when we conflate thinking and knowing, when we set up thinking as equal to knowing, and that's told in this mythological tale of Lucifer setting himself up as equal to God. The moment that we do that, the moment that we set up thinking as equal to knowing, then we take knowing out, because we've got thinking.
We don't need knowing anymore.
We don't need it. Because we think that we know, but we're still just thinking it. Even though we think we know, we're still just thinking.
And so, and that might be that one of the biggest issues on the planet right now.
Yes.
Is that people are using thought and manipulated thought in many ways to know things without finding out the knowing for themselves.
Well, that's right. And they think they know because they can repeat the concepts.
Right, that are being fed to them constantly. Yeah.
Because I can parrot back the same dogmatic platitudes, I can say that I know them. I don't know them. I'm just repeating them, for example. And that's what happens with religious types, is they parrot back the words and they think they know the meaning of them because they can say them and they understand them intellectually, conceptually, but they don't know them. And to know them is to do them. That's the language of knowing is doing.
And right now, I'm just picturing whirling dervishes because that's a way of having experience that you learn the knowing of, from having that a whirling dervish experience. And that doesn't have words to it, doesn't even have
transcends words. So that's another, so we'll go a little bit in a segue on a side note. That's another way to say everything that is worth knowing is meta-rational. It's beyond our thinking. That's very difficult for people who are attached to thinking to accept, because thinkers and thinking types, they think that if I can't think it, then therefore it's not real or it's not meaningful, doesn't matter.
Right. And there are great teachings, like I'm thinking of the Bhagavad Gita, which is a book of words. But while you're reading those words, you're having an experience that's hard to explain.
All great words are pointing you to an experience. That's the best that they can do. The words that point us to the most transcendent experiences are the words that we've hallowed as sacred and we've covered in golden leafed volumes and lit incense around the pages of these words, because the words can point us, they're light bearers, these words, they shine a light. Oh, look over here and have that lived experience and you're going to have a wonderful life.
Right, except
again, the mistake that we make.
Yeah, exactly. There's a mistake to that.
Use the words that the words themselves are the knowing. No,
right.
They're pointers. They can point you. They can shine a light.
Exactly.
So just to finish the mythological story, the fall, when Lucifer sets himself up as equal to knowing, then we don't need the knowing because we have the thinking. That's when hell begins. That's when the fall happens. That's when the same light-bearing energy becomes satanic. That's when Satan emerges. Because
right.
Words are not the same as consciousness. Wherever we set up the words, the concepts, the abstraction, as if it was the thing itself, as if it were reality, as if it had any light for itself, doesn't have any light in itself,
right.
Its only function is to point to a light, that's when we have the fall. That's when we have hell on earth. And that's when the same light bearer transforms and becomes satanic. And instead of the words pointing to conscious awareness and to a lived experience, a reality of doing conscious awareness, the words become closed and constrictive and dogmatic. And then the words no longer are pointing to any reality. The words become dead and hollow and lifeless. And this is what Nietzsche meant when he said, God is dead. That word is dead. It doesn't point to anything meaningful anymore for people because it's become so closed that the word that once served a transcendent light-bearing function, look over to all that is, the creator of all that is, and have a heart-opening, expansive experience with that word that no longer functions that way. And it becomes a closed, hollow, dogmatic loop, and then it's dead.
Right. And this is what the word sin is all about, But sin is, in I don't know which language, means separate from, outside of. And so we become separate from our awareness, our experience, to live in the words of it rather than the experience of it. So then we're in sin. We're living in sin when we've separated ourselves from the true experience.
Well, that's right. And so exactly, to sin means that we've attached reality to our thoughts and we're living as if our thoughts are real. That's sin. And the original sin, the very first mistake we ever make is when we believe that our thoughts are real. And that's what that original story of Adam and Eve teaches. When you eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge, this little tree of knowledge, the central nervous system, the spine and the brain that actually looks like a tree, when you eat from that fruit, you're cast out of paradise. Now you're going to be in a loathsome, toilsome, suffering existence that is devoid of life. Why? Because thoughts aren't real. You're living as if your thoughts are real. That's going to be a suffering existence for you. And that's the same teaching that Buddha taught. If you are attached to your thoughts, you're going to suffer because they're not real.
Thoughts can really take you down the rabbit hole because they can be very distorted.
They're all in our own head.
Right.
We can think whatever we want in our own head. And it's amazing when you really think about it. We're in our own head. I'm in here thinking about everything out there and every person, you and my wife and my kids and whomever. And I'm thinking through my conceptual abstraction about you and thinking that my conceptual abstraction is you. It's really dumb if you think about it, but that's what we do all the time.
Labeling.
Yeah.
Describing. And that's actually known as a difference between feelings and emotions, whereas we have feelings, but then when we attribute labels to those feelings, we describe them as emotions, because it's the only way to describe feelings that are very infinite in themselves, and we try to define them down into emotions that you can label and be mentally more comfortable with, because you've limited the expanse of feelings.
Well, more comfortable with, but also it allows for a dialogue. There's that light-bearing function. If I can name what I'm feeling and put it into a word, then I can tell my wife about it and say, I'm feeling upset. And now I've been able to shine a light on an experience that I'm having. I'm using a word that means something to her, that then now we can talk and create a connection based on the feelings that I'm having. So in that sense, the words are a wonderful light bearer. They shine a light. But where we get into trouble is where we get attached to the words. And it's challenging to talk about. It's very interesting to understand how the words can serve a dual purpose, to be both a light bearer, but to also be something that we can suffer from if we're attached to it.
Yeah, and there's so many people in this world who use words brilliantly to distort truths.
Yeah. Words don't have to be light bearers. We can use words to oppress and restrict and control, which is what biblical monotheism and most religions have done very effectively. This is the dogma. This is the truth. We're going to enclose reality inside of these words. And if you don't agree and don't come into our bubble and live inside our enclosed reality, you're a heathen or a pagan. We're going to punish you and excommunicate you and maybe kill you. Absolutely. Words can be used to control and confine, or words could be used to point and shine a light on our reality. And then we may have an existence where we could talk together. Like right now, I feel personally Like I'm fumbling at the edge of my word limit. I'm reaching for the right words to use to talk about a reality in a way that's intelligible and that communicates something with you. So I'm right now in this moment doing my best to utilize words as light bearers.
Right. And so that's where we can have great understandings or misunderstandings. So it is fragile because it depends on our agreements about words and how we can hold them. And playing a club, for instance, you're more apt to understand the usage of thoughts and language.
Yeah.
Whereas someone who's playing either the spades or the hearts, or even the diamonds, you know, has to invent the languages stronger. I think clubs, people who are clubs are more apt to adapt to thoughts.
By being a club person, you mean someone who's born to play a club card either.
Like me, yeah.
It's true. People who are born to play a club energy in their birth card or personality card tend to have more facility with words. And I have a Seven of Clubs personality, and I do have a gift with words. I've been told that many times, and I...
You sure do, yeah. I appreciate
how
to explain things.
So I want to say something else really important, just going back a step. When you talk about it's the agreement that we have, it's the context in which the words are spoken, and it's the intention with which the words are spoken. And even that, we can utilize this wonderful toolkit of the source cards that was hidden in plain sight to guide us. Because thoughts are flowers that grow on the soil of the heart. There's a lot known now, and there still could be more known, about the connection between the mind and the body. And that's the connection between the club and the diamond. That the thoughts that are thought affect the physicality, the diamond level of reality. So there's been some research on that and some public knowing of that through movies like The Secret, that thoughts become things. What's much less known is that the type of feelings that you have give rise to certain thoughts. Let me explain. If you're happy, you're going to think positive, constructive thoughts. If you're feeling hurt, sad, angry, maybe wounded by something someone said, if you're feeling that bitterness, you're going to think negative, recriminating, judgmental thoughts, always, 100%. So the way to know, again, knowing is consciousness, so spade energy, I'm talking about consciousness right now, the way to know that we're emotionally in a down place is to watch the kind of thoughts. And if the thoughts are negative and critical and judgmental, it means that we're feeling bad somehow, we're feeling low. So in our collective agreement, in our collective dialogue, when people are using words to tear down or to manipulate or to control others, we know for sure that they're feeling bad about themselves in some way. They're insecure in some way. They feel hurt or sad or angry or bitter in some way. And it's coming out in these kind of words and thoughts that they have. But that's not so well known in our society yet. But it will make a big difference when it does become more publicly known.
But I think you being a Seven of Clubs makes you more appreciative of the variance of thinking.
Yeah.
Because the seven can be played up or down. And when you are a seven, you're very aware of the vulnerabilities and the strength of how the card is played. So therefore you're somebody who is very sensitive to the way words are used.
Well, you're right. The seven energy is able to go across the whole spectrum.
Right.
And so in clubs, it gives me the ability, and I know this, that I can talk to anyone. And my wife teases me that I can adopt the mannerisms and the tics and the language style of anyone I'm talking to. And I can put on almost any accent very easily. It's the Seven of Clubs ability. I can talk to highfalutin Wall Street CEOs, Fortune 100. I can talk to homeless people in the street and everything in between. The languaging is there. It's a gift of the Seven of Clubs.
That's wonderful. And now I am thinking of human design and in the human design charts, the body graph of chakras, in some people, the throat is undefined. And when the throat is undefined, it has antennas and mirrors all around it to pick up those nuances because it needs to, because it lacks its own definition. Mm. So it's like the seven lacks the stability of cards that don't go up or down.
Yeah.
And so that would represent an undefined throat. And I don't remember what your chart looks like.
I have all undefined, or all these two are undefined. So.
Uh-huh. You mean the two between the mind and the throat.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it makes sense that because all of these systems reflect each other.
Totally. Yeah. Well, I've learned so much about myself from every one of these systems, and I've studied them all as far as I know.
We met originally because you came to classes I was teaching about human design.
Yeah. I found human design first. Then I found gene keys. Then I found the cards. And at first, when I started out professionally, I intended to triangulate the three so someone would come to me for a reading and they'd know their human design, gene keys, and their cards. And I quickly realized that that was a bit too much to bite off, and I needed to specialize in one, and I picked the cards.
Interesting. Yeah, I like cards just in daily intercourse with people. I pull out my card chart and ask people what their birth dates are. And then it's easy, it's not the full hand, it's just the birth card and the personality card. But those are key cards. And so then I not only know who I'm talking with and how they're going to process me and their conversation, but also that they get excited about it, about knowing themselves better.
Yeah, no, it's very true. So one thing that I wanted to dive into today when I knew we were going to have this conversation, Peter, is to talk about the ways in which biblical monotheism has prejudiced our thinking about what we think reality is based on this grand heritage going back thousands of years that has over thousands of years shaped generation upon generation in the way that we think about our reality, and how that, in my way of looking at it, has actually become constrictive and too narrow and closes us off and sets us up for conflict.
I think in every way that society is labeled, we're limited. And yet, it's a start. I mean, if we know the labels and we understand how restrictive they can be, then we start looking for what's behind the labels.
Well, that would be a good idea, to look behind the labels, but I'm not sure people do that often. And I look behind the labels. That is what we do. Here's the primary way in which I think biblical monotheism has set us up for war and division, subjugation, friction, in-group, out-group dynamics, xenophobia, and so on, is because biblical monotheism, the entire tradition of it, starts with the premise that there is one supreme being. If that is understood as being itself or existence itself, life itself, there's a oneness of being, then yes. But what happens is the mind, attempting to comprehend that, puts that as a concept. And the mind, thinking about the oneness of being, thinks there is one way, there is one truth, there is one idea. And all of a sudden then, now we're into a dogmatic way of approaching reality with the idea, with the thought that there is only one right way, one truth. And as soon as the mind is thinking that, then already, automatically, there is going to be friction with or division from anyone who thinks differently.
This is why the idea of God can't be defined in any mental way, because it's not a mental concept.
No. But we've certainly tried, and there's been much ink spilled on the topic, and the law written, and the scriptures written, and that all of these are words, all of these are ideas, abstractions, and concepts that at their best can point to the oneness of beingness, but people don't take it that way, and they take the concept as if it were the truth itself, and then they're holding up the words themselves as the truth and making everyone else bow to these words and then subjugating humanity to these words. And that's a disaster. That's hell on earth. That's crusades. That's inquisitions. That's slavery. That's cultural wars that we have now, where we have two different ideas, a Republican or Democrat, which is the right idea. Because of biblical monotheism, we have the idea that there can only be one right idea. That's a consequence of the assumption that there is only one right way, one idea, one truth.
So and when we say that God is one, then we get stuck.
We don't know what that means.
Right, we get stuck because God is also everything. And God is also nothing.
Right.
And how can you have a concept that appreciates nothing?
Right. Can't. But that idea of one, God is one, then the mind's concept of one is, oh, there's one, and there's only one. So if you think differently, then you're whatever you are, evil, heathen, traitor, heretic. Because the mind has a concept of one, oneness, that is divisive.
Well, what I want to know is which one. Because all of a sudden, that's the point. So, as soon as you say one, you want to know which one.
Right, because you're pointing at one. And then that, too, is where the separation comes in. Because the mind has a concept of something, and that's separate from something else. It's not one, it's two. It's not one, it's three. I mean, it's not four, it's one. Then we're compartmentalizing existence and we're creating these separations.
Right. As soon as you say one, you're actually creating duality.
Exactly.
Wow.
So this is what happens. As soon as the mind thinks one, then automatically we have duality and we have conflict, automatically. And that's the heritage of biblical monotheism, is duality, which is this extraordinary paradox that biblical monotheism would bequeath us with this duality of conflict.
So maybe it's better for the mind, instead of to think one, think of is.
Well, this is what, for example, someone like Jesus attempted to communicate, just I am, that's it. And then also even in the previous scriptures, in what would be called the Old Testament in the Christian tradition, when God is asked who he is, he's like, I am that I am. And that is that idea.
That's isness.
Isness. I'm just isness. There's no object to the isness. You can't put any concept to it. It's just being itself. It's just isness.
Love that.
But now this is where I come in, and this is where I think something like the source cards are very instrumental. We still think, even if, okay, everything is isness, God is isness, and I amness, we still have a mental faculty, and we still have lives to live, and things we want to do in our lives, and the brain is our creative instrument.
So we're trying to think of what to do with isness.
Exactly. So what do you do with the isness? You can't have a biblical monotheistic underpinning to the isness, because then you have friction and duality. So you need a better toolkit. You need a better metaphysical model. How about a 52 factorial system, which for all intents and purposes is infinite, but it's a limited...
How do you see infinity in that?
Have you seen, and they're up on YouTube, these various videos, that the deck of cards is a 52 factorial system. And what that means is that there's 52 times 52 ways in which the cards can be shuffled. And even though it is a finite number of the ways, the amount of times, different variations the cards can be shuffled, it's a finite number, but for all intents and purposes, it's infinite. All these zeros, like there's more carbon molecules in our planet, there's more grains of sand in our planet than there are, less grains of sand in our planet, less carbon molecules than there are ways that the cards could be shuffled. So for all intents and purposes, it's an infinite construct of different ways we can play out our cards, different ways with our own free will that we can engage this 52 times 52 system. So it gives us infinite possibilities, as opposed to saying there's only one possibility. And if you're not following this possibility, you're a heretic and you're not one of us. You're not doing this one way. The 52 factorial system, hidden in plain sight as a deck of cards, gives literally infinite possibilities for human beings to play out their lives that are all equally valid and all equally true.
Right. No, I know that, and but that's also how we can learn about ourselves in relationship to everybody else.
Well, that's right. And here's something very important to know, which I mentioned earlier, is that this language of life, known historically as the Book of Life, that comes out of the Tree of Life, that comes out of the Flower of Life, this predates biblical monotheism. Biblical monotheism comes later and tried its best to stamp this out and hide it and destroy it and replace this understanding of the 52 factorial infinite possibilities that with our mind we can create our existence, tried to replace it with the idea of, no, there's only one way. You got to follow this law this way. And if you don't follow this one way, you're out.
Because each card in the deck is a different representation of God.
Yes. Of a possibility of creating with our mind an existence that is a reflection of the oneness of all that is.
Wow.
It's a different aspect. So we're all made of the same life. We're all same being, same existence, same substance. And there's an infinite multiplicity ways in which we can represent that oneness of being in our lives.
Yeah. The cards are fascinating. And we never, you and I have done many shows over the years about them, because there's always new downloads that we get and new understandings about how they function. And it's not simple. And that's why it's easy to give people the basic information of their cards, but then it's hard to explain why that information is there.
Well, it can be. I'm starting to see more and more clearly how to talk about the whole system. And today's show, for example, is one of the first times, if not the very first time, that I've put these strands together in one public discourse to talk about the ways in which this language of life offers infinite possibilities for human existence that are all a reflection of the oneness of being. And it predates the biblical monotheistic tradition, which tried to instantiate, no, there's only one way to be, to cover that all up. And now this model of existence is coming back to our consciousness. And we know it intuitively. We know that there are many different ways to live that are all equally valid and equally true. We know that.
And that means we are each valid and true.
Exactly.
And to define it through our birth cards allows us to own our uniqueness.
Well, that's right. And instead of trying to measure yourself against the biblical monotheistic law, whether it's a Jewish tradition, a Muslim tradition, Christian tradition,
right,
any religious tradition, instead of measuring yourself of am I moral or am I living according to what the religion says I should do, no, you live according to your authentic truth of who you are, accurately reflected back to you in your birth card.
Wow, it's amazing, because religious people who study their religions a lot are trying to discover all this, but through ideas that have to do with the way the mind is distorting the experience.
Well, and I would say that they're still making that original mistake, the very first mistake from which all mistakes follow, which is they're conflating thinking and knowing. And they think they know.
And that's the distortion.
Yeah.
And that's why there's no end to the study of religion, because it never gets to the point.
No. No matter how fine-tuned you get your thinking to be, you can never arrive at knowing through thinking. And this is something that 20th century philosophers, to their credit, figured out. Philosophers like Derrida, Jacques Derrida, the French philosopher, who realized and said quite famously that the text is infinitely extensible, text, reality, and that there's infinite interpretability of the text. It's infinite. It just continues infinitely. You're infinitely interpreting reality. You never are arriving at truth. You're just continually interpreting it.
And the mind gets lost in that. And then we judge each other according to any sprout that shows up that we can add another definition to that is only a concept.
It's all interpretation. The biblical monotheistic tradition is an interpretation of the oneness of being, ascribing a oneness of life path, you could say, like live in this one way, and then you'll be living out the oneness of being.
Yeah, and thinking that if you interpret it enough, you'll solve the problem.
That's right.
It's just winding itself into itself. It's a snake eating its tail.
That's right. And even now, in talking about it, I find that I'm at the limit of my own words in the attempt to explain the limitation of words using words. It's a very interesting paradox that we're describing the limitations of words and thinking with our thinking using words.
Yeah, because we are. I mean, that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
And yet, if we step away from the thinking for even a second, we can be in infinite space.
And that's the part that is not necessarily easy. That's the letting go of our attachment to our thinking, which in Eastern philosophical religious terms is letting go of ego. Because who we think we are is our ego. And
the ego is mine.
It's our thought construct of ourselves. It's who we think that we are, and that can even in me, I think I'm a human being, right? That is a mental attachment as well. What if I'm pure spirit and pure energy that's incarnated in temporarily into this human vessel? Then I need to let go of the ego attachment, even that I'm a human being.
Well, this sounds like it's actually like the teaching of Milarepa in Tibetan Buddhism, which I don't want to get into because he suffered so greatly to experiencing life, and the only way he could get beyond it was to let go of everything.
Mm.
And so that's what we all have to do, to at least let go of all of the constructs that we're living for. And then start living for nothing.
Well, I would actually say I would disagree with that, Peter. And I would.
I know. I hope so, but it's limited to say that.
I would say that that's where we consciously focus on playing our cards right. And for example, someone who's born to play an ace energy, they're here to initiate something. They're not here to let it go. They're here to roll up their sleeves and get in there and initiate something. Someone who's playing a four, you're here to organize stuff and structure it and work with the clay of life to build something. It's only the nine energy that is here to transcend and rise above and leave it all behind. But classically, I believe, I have no proof of this, but if I were able to look up the birth cards of all of our great religious teachers, they're probably born to play a nine energy when they talk about letting go of attachment, giving up your possessions, forgiving everyone, and going out in the desert. Those are all very nine things to do. And we're not all here to play that game.
No, you're talking about the enlightened leaders.
if that's what we want to call them.
Yeah, because they know to surrender because it's not getting us anywhere to keep processing. But let's come back to the spade and what the spade represents.
Yeah.
And how to live with the spade, because there are 13 different numbers of living with a spade.
Well, it's to live with the conscious awareness that we're here to play out a game and to play our cards right, quite literally. And so, for example, like I was just saying, if you're born to play a nine energy as I am, the nine of hearts, then that looks like transcendence. But we make a mistake if we conflate that with somehow being spiritual. But it has been that way historically. People have conflated being transcendent and letting go of attachment and possessions. They've called that, oh, that's the spiritual path. But that's the mental label, the mental construct. Because in reality, all of the cards to play are equally spiritual. And someone who's rolling up their sleeves and building something, they're just as spiritual as someone who's leaving it all behind and walking away from all material things.
Right, right. There's no one better
right.
style
of more spiritual than the other.
Right, because every moment is another moment of beingness.
Sorry.
And so we don't have to use life to be. Because then we apply concepts to it. So the idea is just to know, to become that isness is the ultimate experience of beingness that we can have that might fulfill our desire to let go.
Well, but I'm saying that not everybody has the desire to let go. That's the point I'm making. That letting go is a nine energy to let go. In your isness and suchness and in your, so you asked about the spade energy, which is consciousness, conscious awareness. And in some sense, I'm lucky because I have a prime example in my life of my son who's born to play the Ace of Diamonds. He is consciously aware, and we all have noticed that about him since he was a little boy. He's very tuned in and aware. But he has no desire to let go, and he's playing an ace energy anyway. So he's going to be wanting to do something, to be impactful, to be forceful in some way, which is the opposite of letting go.
Well, that's his isness.
Right. So that has nothing nothing to do with his consciousness.
I get it. Yeah, right.
But classically, we've made a mental label on letting go. That's the spiritual pathway. No, that's just a mental label of what spirituality is. The isness and suchness of being wants to initiate and do stuff just as much as it wants to let go of stuff.
Yeah, and this is what Arjuna was talking about in the Bhagavad Gita when he had just learned about oneness, wholeness, beingness, isness, and said, well, now I'm a warrior. I have to go into war, but I just want to be. And he was told, no, you're here to actually play out the role that you came for. Mm. And that's your beingness.
Right. Yeah.
So that was profound to read that. We're getting near the end of the show. Let people know more about you.
Sure. My wife and I run thesourcecards.com. You can come to the homepage of the Source Cards, put in your birthday, and get your free reading to find out your birth card and personality card. Then we have a free giveaway when you join our mailing list to find all 13 cards in your life path. You can read my book, take classes, join our community, find out more about how to master the game of your life.
Right. And I know so many people who go to your website because they just want to know more about not only their own card, but all the people they have birthdays for.
You can put in any birthday and look up anyone in your life.
Yeah, it's such a gift. It's amazing that the cards are an incredible gift to people. Actually surrender to what they're here for.
That's right. And that's a perfect way to close because it gives us a mental map of the reality that is already present for us. And that's why I think that these cards are a great conceptual toolkit to help us conceptualize the reality that we're here to live. And in that sense, it shines a light. Again, this idea of how words and concepts can shine a light. It shines a light on our existence.
Right. And I love it when I'm with people who know each other, let's say a group of people, and each person learns about the card of each person in the group and goes, aha, no wonder, and that's so right about that person. And so it helps people in social situations appreciate each other.
It shines a light for us to understand each other.
Yeah, I love it. So we'll do another show fairly soon with you and your wife, Vicki, to talk about a lot of the different cards and what to expect of them and of each other. And because it's great to hear it from, you know, your own words in person. And you guys have so much to constantly, I mean, I've studied cards a lot. I learned them 45 years ago from my mother who told me about my cards. And yet, knowing you guys, it just keeps growing and growing in value and wonder to me.
Well, thank you, Peter. I really appreciate the opportunity to share these ideas and to talk with you about these ideas.
Well, I'm so happy to. And thanks, you know, this is a fairly new show. This is only a third episode of The Soul Knows. And now we're learning what the soul knows in this show. It's so cool. So I really appreciate climbing into to what this is all about. So thank you so much for being a guest on The Soul Knows.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And this is Peter Roth, your host of The Soul Knows. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org. Love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening.